I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Baltimore is going to buy 100 hybrid buses. Colorado will build an interchange with an underpass for elk crossings as states begin to use their stimulus money. Seniors will soon receive their $250 payment, and starting April 1st, Americans earning less than $75,000 a year will receive part of their $400 tax credit. States have started putting their stimulus programs on the White House website. We'll link to it at hereandnow.org. As we start today with Wall Street Journal reporter Elizabeth Williamson. And Elizabeth, this money has provoked huge fights in states over how to spend it.
That's true, Robin. If you look at the state of Texas, for example, they've got kind of the opposite problem of most of the country. I mean, you have this money being spent probably, many would argue that it can't be spent quickly enough in order to jumpstart things in the economy. But in Texas, you have a coalition of citizens groups who are saying, well, wait a minute, we want a little bit more say into how this money is spent. Texas will be getting $2.25 billion in transportation money, and you're spending it too quickly. You're narrowing down $300 billion worth of projects in just a couple of weeks to just a couple billion dollars, and we want more say in what those projects actually are. So it's really funny. It sort of fits and starts, peaks and troughs, and hurry up and wait.
Right. And in Washington, for instance, the state of Washington, the mayor and the governor want Seattle to put a major thoroughfare there underground, but legislators outside of the city of Seattle want things like guardrails fixed and roads fixed. They want it to go to tons of little projects. So there's going to be a lot of debate. But you mentioned the goal of jump-starting the economy and construction employment, the construction industry, saying that their unemployment rate has risen twice the national average. Do you have a sense of how soon people might actually feel this? Because here in Massachusetts, some critics are saying that some of these projects, road projects at least, might not get started till the fall.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's interesting that the early focus has been on the infrastructure projects, because that was always a sort of source of criticism of this bill, by saying Republicans in particular were saying, look, this transportation and infrastructure spending isn't going to be felt. And many economists join them on both sides of the aisle, saying it'll be about 18 months before this money is felt in the larger economy and felt in the unemployment rate. But, you know, in some areas, this money's moving very, very quickly. That Seattle fight is interesting, because that what that underground project would do is replace something that local folks call the Big Ugly, which is an above-ground sort of waterfront transportation system that that they've really wanted to replace for quite a long time. So, you know, you have a lot of regional, very specific and esoteric fights, and you have a lot of spending that will probably be held up until some of those fights are resolved.
Well, on the other hand, some other spending may go out quickly because they don't have to be shovel-ready. Here in Massachusetts, there's a health clinic company, North Shore Community Health Incorporated. Senator John Kerry says with the $1.3 million the state is getting, North Shore Community Health will be able to treat 7,000 additional patients and create 50 jobs. Two clinics already open. They'll open a third. But what about some of the other money, energy money? Is there other money going out?
Well, let's back up and look at HUD money. The Department of Housing and Urban Development would get more funds to crack down on mortgage fraud, for example. It would also get money to promote affordable housing, to build affordable housing. And in the budget, they're scheduled to get even more money. But that money's going out relatively quickly. But then if you look over to the Department of Energy, you have a situation where they've got some $40 billion on tap, and they're having an awfully hard time spending that money quickly enough. Some of my colleagues here at the Wall Street Journal had done a story on this, saying that the Department of Energy is really emblematic of the effort by the United States to try and spend this money as fast as possible, and also has become a sort of poster child for their inability to do so just because of the sheer volume of funds.
And it's also pretty tricky. You're not talking about just spackling a road or putting up a new guardrail. It's potentially redoing the electric infrastructure.
That's absolutely right. You could have up to $170 billion put into projects like internet broadband, like public housing repairs, but that $40 billion would go out to such things as modernizing the electrical grid, creating the so-called smart grid program, building electric cars, and making homes and buildings more energy efficient. None of that can be done in a day.
It would seem that the thing Americans might feel most quickly are the social safety net programs, food stamps and such. Are those increases going out?
Yes, they are. This is a source of cash that's pretty easy to channel because the pathway to states and municipalities already exists. So it's just a matter of sending more money to those specific programs that are already there. But in the case of infrastructure and energy, you've got money going into new projects that therefore have to go through all of the bureaucratic hoops to be approved and to receive the money.
Wall Street Journal reporter Elizabeth Williamson on the stimulus money that's beginning to be funneled out across the country. Elizabeth, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, there have been so many questions about the economy. Periodically, we pause to catch up on answers. And today, it's financial writer Roger Lowenstein's turn to help us do that. He says he's writing the book on the causes of the financial crisis as we speak, but is taking a break for us today. Roger, thank you. And we were just talking about the stimulus package. The goal is to inject confidence into the economy. So speaking of that, just yesterday, the president said people should go out and buy stocks. Question one, your thoughts on that?
You know, that's a good thing for him to say. The risk is you can only say it so many times. And if the street, you know, rallies from here, the president may be getting offers from, you know, Morgan Stanley if he can predict the market that well. It's a fine thing to do, but it's a bullet you can only fire once or twice. If you fire it and it misfires, it'll lose its effect.
I mean, if the markets then tumble and people are upset that they chose
that
moment
again.
Yeah,
there's only so many times. Yeah. I mean, the president can't really be the stockbroker in chief, on a regular basis.
Well, let's go from spending and investing to cutting costs. President Obama says his $3.6 trillion budget will raise taxes on people who make more than $250,000 a year, in part by rolling back the Bush tax cuts. He'll also cut the amount of charitable donations wealthy people can deduct. In other words, it's more progressive taxing, higher taxes on capital gains. These are the windfalls, like the sale of a home, for people who make more than $250,000. You know, put that in context. Are we getting taxes on the wealthy higher than, let's say, they were before the Reagan Revolution?
No. Before the Reagan Revolution, you really have to blink to take in this number. The marginal tax rate was 70%. That was also the era when there were all these tax shelters and ways for people, legal ways for people to avoid taxes. And the idea of the various reforms, one was to lower the rate substantially. He took it down to 28%, and the other was to say, okay, the rate's low, but you got to pay it, no more tax shelters. And that pretty much worked. And the huge debate which has happened in the years since between the George Bush the first and Clinton together raised taxes to 39%.
On the very wealthy.
Yeah, and then on the marginal rate, and then between Bush the second, who cut them back down to 35. You know, it's a debate in a very narrow territory, and nobody has suggested taking them back up to where they were in the President Johnson era or back down to 28. The question or the worry is that will it be enough to go to 39%? I mean, the expense side is really the worry in this for a lot of people, and these deficits are looking very big, and these are projected deficits, and, you know, sometimes the reality turns out to be worse.
Well, and so up at around 39%, President Obama says that new tax money, that new revenue coming in from the very wealthy will help pay for health care.
It certainly will, and he's actually raising a little more than 39%. He wants to winnow out some deductions or reduce them on things like home mortgages for the wealthy. It'll certainly help pay for health care, but, you know, health care has a way of turning out to be more expensive than people project. And there's not only health care, there's energy and there's student loans. There's still a war to fight in Afghanistan and one to unwind in Iraq. And it was in 2001 that then Fed Chief Greenspan was fretting that we would have surpluses for as far as the eye could see. You know, the worry is just how much we're taking on and how we're going to finance.
Well, you mentioned one thing in passing, the idea of reducing the home mortgage deduction. Now, is this only for people making over $250,000?
Yes. And if I can get in a soapbox, I mean, they should really think about doing away with for everyone, which wouldn't be very popular. But, you know, it's a break for people who own homes, which means effectively it penalizes people who rent.
Well, even some Democrats, though, are opposed to this idea because this is the only deduction for a lot of Americans without children, for instance. So, you know, you're standing there on your soapbox. Go for it. Why shouldn't there be some break, you know, for people who are pouring money into homes?
Why shouldn't there be some break for people who are pouring money into rent? Breaks don't fall out of the sky. They're paid for by people who don't get them. That's the reason. I mean, the other reason is we had a bunch of policies to encourage homeownership in both the Clinton and the Bush eras. And obviously you don't need policies to encourage home ownership for people who have them anyway. So we had policies to help people get homes who might not have otherwise. And it turned out that when you bend the market to provide more homes and more mortgages than it otherwise would, you can have some bad results. And we ended up with an awful lot of people in mortgages that they couldn't afford. So, you know, maybe people who can afford mortgages should have them and other people should rent.
Concentrate on building affordable housing for renters.
Concentrate on building a healthy economy so that people can get jobs and spend their money on rent or housing or wherever they choose to.
Let's take a look at the entitlement programs. Entitle being the key word, because are you hearing signals from the president that Social Security, Medicare, which is the health care program for the elderly and the disabled, might begin to be means tested? In other words, people who have means, money, may not get the Medicare benefits that they expect.
I haven't heard any signals from the president, but I think that's likely. I think that, you know, health care is something where you can make discretionary cuts. Also, the Medicare deficit is potentially much greater.
Right.
Far greater. Social Security also has a deficit. I think they're less likely to means test that. I think they're more likely to trim Social Security for everybody in ways such as maybe raising the age at which you qualify for full payments.
Or could there be the possibility with Social Security of a relatively large group of people, including Warren Buffett, for instance, the super wealthy, saying, you know what, I'm going to voluntarily not take my couple $1,000s a month because that's chump change to me.
You know, it's really not going to make a difference if Warren Buffett forgoes his Social Security. But right now, Social Security is only taxed on the first $100,000 of income. I think it's much more likely the government would say, look, right now, if you earn $1 million a year, you pay the same payroll tax as if you earn $100,000. That seems sort of crazy. So maybe after some level, you know, maybe after $300,000 or something, you start paying payroll tax again, so you'd contribute more, but still maintain the sort of hallmark, you know, postcard version that when you retire, whether you're Warren Buffett or whether you're clean Warren Buffett's office, you each get a stipend.
Well, you mentioned Medicare, and I do want to pick up on that again. You told us when we spoke last summer that Medicare and Social Security were a looming crisis, but that was before the current financial crisis, and analysts are now moving up the Medicare trust failure from 2019 to the year 2016. They say that because of the current economy, Medicare could go bust that quickly. That's less than, you know, 10 years. Your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, it's got to be fixed. And the country really faces, you know, a question which so far it's always resolved in favor of more spending. That is to say, you know, if you ask Americans to vote for maybe we should all wait longer for a hip replacement, maybe when doctors recommend potential CAT scans or other tests, we don't have to have them as often. That's never been popular in this country. That is, you know, what happens in most other societies. Not everybody gets every test and treatment. I don't think Americans are ready to give that up.
And as you said, they maybe have to get ready to accept that they're just going to pay more into Medicare to keep it going. That's Roger Lowenstein. Just one man's opinion as we periodically check in with financial writers. He'll be back. Also later today, a champion of the rails who says stimulate freight trains. Back in a minute here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with financial writer Roger Lowenstein. He's working on a book on the causes of the current financial crisis. And Roger, before the break, we were talking about Medicare, but before we leave entitlement programs, let's just go back to Social Security for a moment, because I know you're concerned about dwindling pension funds at huge companies with a lot of retirees like GM, and now at states because of the collapse of the stock market. We talked about means testing for wealthy people, but do you think Social Security benefits may someday be cut for everyone?
That's sort of the last safety net. You may remember that President Bush, the 43, wanted to privatize Social Security. I think we can, you know, sort of partially, I mean, we thank our stars that Social Security wasn't invested in stocks. Mm-hmm. But I think it'd be a very funny time to chip away at that. That said, the pension crisis and the crisis of states and municipalities, I think, is also going to wind up in some way or another at the federal government's doorstep.
Well, let's just move to a couple last.
It's all good news.
Yes, I know.
It's
so cheery.
One unending spate of cheer.
Well, one of the ideas on the table at President Obama's health care summit tomorrow is also something we've spoken to you about in the past, and that's treating employer-provided health care benefits as income. Right now, they're tax-free. If you get a health plan through your company, it's tax-free. And the thinking is, let's, you know, even the playing field so that employees of a company who are, in effect, getting extra salary are more on an even playing field with freelance workers
who have
to pay for their own.
Very much akin with the home mortgage deduction. You know, right now the tax code gives a break to people who own a home or have a mortgage as opposed to renters, and it gives a break to people who have employer-subsidized health care plans as opposed to others. And there's no reason to, you know, if your company gives you a car, that's income. If your company gives you a health care plan, that's income. And, you know, as part of a larger rehaul, hopefully that provides some amount of health care for everybody at some price, there's no reason for people to have that break.
Roger, a story that's right in the news today. We read today that dozens of ex-leaders of Countrywide Financial are making millions from the home mortgage mess.
Oh, that made me so mad. I read that.
Well, let's explain to people. Countrywide is sort of the poster child for the subprime mess. They, sold a lot of these risky mortgages. They were bought by Bank of America at a bargain rate last year. And now these former executives are buying up the failed, you know, home mortgages that the government took from failed banks.
Yeah,
sometimes
pennies
on the dollar.
They're going to make a potload of money doing it. It's actually good news, although it's infuriating. What's infuriating is that these executives of this bank that was really terribly run, and it was run like a boiler room. They were throwing money, mortgages, at anybody and everybody who applied for them.
Whether or not they had work, whether or not they could
Whether or not they had work, whether or not they could document their work.
Whether or not they understood that there would be a huge exploding interest rate in it. I mean, just...
Whether or not it was for a primary residence or their eighth home that they were going to flip in an hour and a half later. The good news in the story, if you can get past the sense of fury that I read when I read this, because they're going to make a lot of money, is that these people are out buying mortgages. That's good because it takes them off the hands of either banks or the government, which has seized them. And that's what we've been reading about, is let's get rid of these toxic assets. And the other piece of good news is that they're expressing confidence by buying them, saying, hey, these mortgages are really worth more than they're trading for, i.e., more people are going to pay on their mortgages than the market is giving credit for.
Huh.
And, you know, that's sort of how the system recovers. And, you know, it's a good thing. It is infuriating that people who really had a big hand in creating the problem are going to make a bundle on the way up and be the agents of its recovery. But, you know, do we want to, you know, stop them and risk slowing down the recovery? You know, I don't think so.
Well, as someone was quoted in the Times saying, it's sort of like the arsonist who set fire to the house, buying up the remains, but at least cleaning up the area. And you know,
it is, and it points out that, you know, it's not what's illegal that gets you; it's what you can get away with is legal. And the arson that the Countrywides of the world committed, you know, at least, you know, an arsonist goes to jail. But in this case, regulations were so lax that you could really perpetuate what I would call a fraudulent type of mortgage operation, and not be charged with it.
One last question for you, Roger Lowenstein. Speaking of things that made people furious, excessive pay for CEOs. You call it the original sin that led to a lot of the problems we see today. People would agree, I'm sure. President Obama is trying to limit executive pay to $500,000 a year for companies that just get the bailout money, and they'd also limit severance packages for dismissed executives. But you have another recommendation. What's that?
Well, my recommendation is based on the idea that the problem isn't just what CEOs earn, and it's not just what CEOs of companies getting TARP money earn. The problem is that executives at and beneath the CEO level, down to the trader level, the level of people who put on these big bets, have been making way too much money in good years, or at least what they assume were good years, laying on these large bets, being compensated over very short time frames, and being incented to take tremendous risks. And so my suggestion is just, look, if you're going to pay somebody more than some seemingly excessive amount, the number I came up with is $5 million. It's not the government's business to regulate it, but it is a shareholder's because it's their company. Just put it in the proxy statement and let the shareholders vote on it. Not non-binding, but binding. And, you know, I think if the shareholders had the right to vote on corporate pay packages, you'd see them become a lot more modest.
That's Roger Lowenstein. He's our financial advisor today. We periodically just dip into all the headlines and try to sort through things, and we've been doing it with Roger today. He's writing the book on the financial crisis as we speak. His previous book, While America Aged, How Pension Debts Ruined General Motors, Stopped the New York City Subways, Bankrupted San Diego, and Loom as the Next Financial Crisis. That was before the next financial crisis hit. Roger, thanks as always.
Robin, a pleasure.
Okay, looking ahead, tomorrow on Here and Now, he's pretty busy running the Kennedy Center, but Michael Kaiser offered to help other arts organizations survive, and he's had hundreds of takers. Also, he's mad as heck and not taking it anymore. A businessman is now encouraging others not to pay income taxes to protest the plan to help out homeowners with failing mortgages. That's all tomorrow. Still ahead today, looking for a new job? Well, England's monasteries are looking for monks. After the news, Here and Now. President Obama has promised to fix the nation's infrastructure by proposing a once-in-a-generation project he says would rival the creation of the federal highway system back in the 50s. As we've been hearing today, his stimulus package contains nearly $50 billion dedicated to enhancing transportation, the bulk of it for building and improving roads, highways, and bridges. But in addition, there's $8 billion for high-speed passenger rail service. Well, Philip Longman says, wait a minute, what about freight trains? Phil is a railroad champion and a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, a think tank. He joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Phil, welcome.
Good to be here, Robin.
And make your case. You're not even saying rails in addition to roads. You're really saying rails over roads. Why?
Well, ultimately, we could get as many as 83% of all long-haul trucks off the roads simply by making some, in today's terms, modest investments.
Well, in fact, you say that a single train can move as many containers as 280 trucks while using a third the energy. And, of course, it's better energy, it's a different carbon footprint, and it gets some of the scary trucks off the road.
And, in fact, through electrification, we can run railroads that are powered by solar or wind or hydro, zero emissions.
And you tell a story of, you know, short-sightedness on the part of the owners of a hydropower rail line that once ran across Montana. This is in 1973, right around the oil crisis.
That was the Milwaukee Road. Its full name was, fun to say, Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul, and Pacific. And it had this wonderful system for pulling freight trains over the Rockies. They basically used the water from melting glaciers to run dams that produced the hydropower that went to the wires that powered the trains. Unfortunately, due to lack of foresight, the railroad pulled out those wires in 1973, right on the verge of the oil crisis. Today, the whole railroad is bankrupt. Much of it is a bike trail. It's just a national treasure that we lost.
And they pulled out the wire to sell it for money.
Yeah, for scrap.
Well, you quote a study saying it would take $250 to $500 billion to electrify the rail infrastructure, get that 83% of long-haul trucks off the roads, reduce greenhouse gas emission by 38%. But you also talk about unclogging rail choke points. In Chicago, for example, you say it takes 48 hours for a train to travel just 5 miles. That's longer than it takes for it to get to Chicago from New York. Another major choke point, Baltimore?
There's an obscure tunnel in Baltimore that's so old that it's on the National Register of Historic Places. It's too narrow to get container trains through it. And so trains are not competitive all along the I-95 corridor. All it would take is shovel a little deeper into that tunnel to make it tall enough to get the trains through, and we could divert a huge percentage of the trucks that are on 95.
But even if we clear out I-95, and for our listeners outside of the area, this is the heavily congested interstate that runs from Maine all the way down to Florida and comes through Boston, New York, Philly, and as you mentioned, Baltimore. You write a lot of trucks have moved inland to I-81. Now, this isn't as big a road, and it's terrifying drivers on I-81.
If you drive this road, you'll see that it's being pounded to pieces by long-haul trucks, and it's really a white-knuckle driving experience because it's a hilly road, at least through Virginia. And so, you know, you have this experience of having to constantly pass trucks only to have them pass you on the downgrade.
And it's very serious in Virginia. It's a deadly problem, first of all, because of trucking accidents. But also, one out of every four vehicles on that road is a truck. So what did state officials there decide to do?
the first thought was to build more lanes. You know, that's what highway departments do. But then when they costed that out, it was just fantastically expensive. But as it turns out, by accident of history, there's two rail lines that run parallel to I-81, owned by the Norfolk Southern Railroad. So people in Virginia have had the rather progressive idea of saying, instead of spending public money to widen the lanes on I-81 or to put tolls in, why don't we take some relatively modest amount of public money and have a joint public-private partnership with the railroad to expand their infrastructure so that we can avoid putting all that money into another highway.
Yes, we get trucks off the road, but what would the taxpayer get back? I mean, unlike a bank bailout, taxpayers aren't going to get their investment back, their money back. So what do they get back?
Oh, well, they get many quid pro quos. In exchange for investing in their infrastructure, we get public access to that infrastructure. So, for example, if Virginia wants to run commuter trains or more commuter trains, that increased capacity from the public investment enables this public good commuter trains to be possible.
Well, and why isn't this happening? Why isn't more attention going to the rails? You write that high-speed railway post office trains used to give much more efficient mail service to small towns. It's, you know, unmatched today. So what happened? Why did people's opinions of trains change outside of the fact that, okay, cars came along and we fell in love with them? What else happened?
Well, the railroads, starting in the late 19th century, endured a really horrific regulatory regime that put them at a great disadvantage with trucks and autos. I mean, they're private companies. They pay property taxes on their own infrastructure. They maintain that infrastructure. Meanwhile, by mid-20th century, tremendous amounts of public money was going into highways and airport construction, so the railroads were essentially financing their own competitors. And then we went into a long period of slow decline. We almost totally lost the rail industry in the 1970s. And at last, it got some regulatory relief and it has begun to rebound.
But even when rail lines do rebound, say in the late 80s, when fuel costs started skyrocketing and shippers wanted an alternative to trucks, so much track had been abandoned by then or torn up that railroads couldn't meet the demand. So, you know, once again, it's a vicious cycle. They're seen as being a failure.
That's right. There's one other question that, you know, to your judgment, which you want to hear. But one of the things people ask is, well, this is such a great technology and the railroads are coming back. Why don't they pay for their own infrastructure?
And the answer?
Well, the answer is that Wall Street went nuts in the 1990s and in this decade. They took the world's savings and they put them in track houses and for the most part told railroads, we're not interested in your industry. It doesn't have a high enough rate of return.
And so the railroads don't have the money.
They don't have the money now. There are people like Warren Buffett and other patient, smart, long-term investors who are making big bets on railroads. But for now, between the credit crunch and the short-sightedness of typical Wall Street investment firm, the industry is starved for capital. And that's what creates the context for needing public investment.
Well, you're not the only one saying, look to rails, look to rails. We just had Ray Magliazzi, often referred to as Click, of Click and Clack, one of the Car Talk Tappet brothers. And, you know, he absolutely believes that that rebuilding the rails can also rebuild Detroit because Detroit auto workers can be the ones to build the locomotives, the trains that we need.
Yes, in fact, General Motors, until they sold the division, was the world's leading maker of diesel-electric railroad locomotives. General Electric still is a world leader in that business, and it has an idled plant in Erie, Pennsylvania that could go to work right away.
That's Philip Longman. He's senior fellow at the New America Foundation, a public policy institute in Washington, D.C. His article, Back on Track, appears in Washington Monthly Magazine. For more, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. He also has a new book coming out in April. It's called The Next Progressive Era, A Blueprint for Broad Prosperity. Somehow I think it will include freight trains. Phil, thanks for your time and best to you.
Thank you, Robin.
The Catholic Church in the U.S. is dealing with a shortage of priests, but England's monasteries are also in decline. In 2007, only 13 men became novice monks in Catholic orders in Great Britain. And in response, some monasteries have started to run what are called taster nights to try to recruit prospective monks. As part of the deal, you take your meals in silence and pray five times a day. One of the English monasteries holding these taster weekends is Worth Abbey in the southern county of West Sussex, and the BBC's Yvonne Murray visited and prepared this report for us.
Those who are coming on our monastic taster weekends stay in one of our guest rooms.
Sparsely decorated with a crucifix on the wall and a Bible by the bed, the rooms are designed to look like the monks' quarters. Father Luke Jolly runs the residential weekends.
They've got a comfortable bed, which they'll enjoy for the night, but they'll be getting up 6:20 as our first monastic prayer.
Visitors are expected to follow the rhythm of the monks' daily life. That means rising at dawn.
Bless our community through this meal and renew the
eating in silence while listening to a reading. This lunchtime notably from a biography of the Archbishop of Canterbury.
The fault lines in Verne's doctrine of the church have already been brought out.
I'm walking to the church for prayers five times a day. Why do you think this is necessary now? Why do you have to reach out to people and bring them in? Shouldn't you have faith that they will come anyway?
We have faith, but there are so many different opportunities that sometimes they can miss the signposts, and we're just trying to point out where the signpost is and then offer them help in making that journey.
I'm walking down the steps now on my way to the quiet garden, and it's here by the stone bridge and the gentle waterfall that the young people come to contemplate life in a religious order.
When I first started coming on the weekends, the services seemed really boring and I couldn't wait to get through the booklet.
By the reflective pool, I meet Lisa Padgett, who's completed a series of 9 weekends here. With her highlighted hair and thoroughly modern facial piercing, she looks an unlikely candidate for monastic life. In fact, she spent some years as an atheist, dabbled with Hinduism, and at one point was engaged to be married. But now she's thinking of becoming a nun.
As a convert, I didn't know that many Catholics, so it was great to meet a bunch of young Catholics who were thinking about religious life. It made it seem a bit more normal.
The celibacy thing was one of the biggest things in my head, like, could I actually do that?
Slatter is a recent media graduate, but he's wondering if the priesthood is his real calling.
If you're thinking about religious life, it's far easier to come on this kind of try before you buy, no strings attached, than it would be to knock on the door of a monastery and say, I think I might want to join.
These days there are a few people like Rick and Lisa. In 2007 there were just 29 novices in the Catholic Church in England and Wales, compared to more than 200 some 25 years ago. But the monks at Worth Abbey believe their life of obedience, stability, poverty and chastity still has plenty to offer the modern world. The abbot is Christopher Jamieson.
This is a rivetingly exciting life. It's just it's completely different. I put it this way. Modern life often looks very exciting from the outside, but like some glitzy magazines, there's not much in it. Whereas here in the monastery, it's the opposite. The outside's very calm, but what's going on inside is pulsating with life.
And convincing more people of that, they hope, will help to prevent this 1,500-year-old tradition dying out.
That story came to us from the BBC's Yvonne Murray. For more on Worth Abbey and its Taster Weekend, go to our website, herenow.org. And this note, in staying with Great Britain, Senator Ted Kennedy will soon receive an honorary knighthood. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, who's in Washington today, said the Massachusetts Democrat and Irish-American is being recognized for his part in the peace process in Northern Ireland. Unlike British knights, Americans who receive this honor are not entitled to use the words Sir or Dame before their names, so do not call him Sir Ted. He probably wouldn't like that anyway. Just ahead, that annoying now that we can hear it recurring chord progression. Back in a minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back.
You come out at night. That's when the energy comes and the dark
For our entertainment writer Mark Hirsch, it all began in 1998 when he noticed that Sarah McLachlan's Building a Mystery sounded an awful lot like Joan Osborne's 1995 hit, One of Us.
If God had a name, what would it be, and would you call it to his face?
And then along came Beyonce this past summer with the same chord progression in the ubiquitous If I Were a Boy.
Beer with the guys and chase after girls.
Mark came up with a name for this. He calls it the sensitive female chord progression, which we should add, guys can play too. Mark wrote about all of this in the Boston Globe and joins us in the studio. What exactly is the progression?
I've been thinking about it for years as minor 6, major 4, major 1, major 5. But as many Berkeley students have pointed out, it is more accurately designated as minor 1, major 6, major 3, flat 7.
Well, but if you don't know anything about any of that,
of course,
and you're speaking of Berklee School of Music students who do know all about that, you say you can just sing Joan Osborne's, What If God Were One of Us, over any song, just to see if it has the chord progression.
That is correct.
So let's do this. Let's listen to Joan Osborne again with One of Us, and as it goes along, you know, tell me where the chord changes are, okay, for the uninitiated, for the non-musician, okay?
Okay.
Yeah.
Here's the minor 6, the major 4, the major 1, the major 5.
Okay.
Minor 6, major 4, major 1, major 5.
Okay.
And so forth.
Okay. Now, here's what I want to do now. If we could cue up in there, we're driving everyone crazy on the other side of that glass. If we could just cue up Sarah McLachlan, okay? Now, I want you to sing Joan Osborne with me over Sarah McLachlan. Okay, yes.
What if God was one of us?
That's when the energy comes.
Just a slob like one of us.
Vampires roam.
Just a stranger. Oh, that's the part that switches.
Okay.
That's
that was amazing for as far as it went. You talked to Eric Bazillion of the Hooters, who wrote One of Us, that Joan Osborne sings, that you say just, like, owns this female chord progression. He's a guy. What did he say to you?
As soon as he called me back when I requested an interview, the message they left on my voicemail was excitement that somebody else had finally spotted this thing that he's been living with for 10 years, because he had noticed this exact same phenomenon, just song after song after song. And he certainly doesn't feel as though he needs to get everybody that has used this chord progression, because
right.
He's certainly not the first one to use it either.
But you talk to other people, too, about what it might be doing, you know, and especially since, men use it as well. Well, there's the man who wrote it, Eric Bazillion. But also, Green Day's Holiday. Let's just take a listen.
What if God was one of us?
God was one of us. So, guys using it, too. But what do you think specifically it does for women? Because that was definitely a different feel with Green Day. So what is it doing, that you call it this, female chord progression?
First of all, it's important to realize that the reason I gave it that name was that the songs that I was hearing that fit this chord progression were all women. And specifically, they were all women who would be on stage at a Lilith Fair.
Yeah, I was
they
just going to say. Lilith
Joan
Fair,
Osborne,
right.
Sarah McLachlan, Melissa Etheridge, Jewel used it, and then Nina Gordon, who used to be in Veruca Salt, which was a very hard rock band, she made her pop move using this chord progression with a song called Tonight and the Rest of My Life.
I hear it.
Now, over the years, there have been plenty of songs that have completely violated the name Sensitive Female Chord Progression.
Right.
One of the more aggressive ones is The Offspring, and you can listen to the song Self-Esteem, which is one of the big ones that sort of helped make their name in 1994.
I know I'm being used. It's okay, man, because I like the abuse.
We you talk to musicologists about what this progression might be doing, you know, as opposed to, you know, something that just does a crescendo and stays up on the crescendo. This is kind of a circular thing. What do people tell you?
One of the reasons why I'm sure it works the way it does and it's so popular, it continues to come up over and over again, and the reason why I was corrected by a lot of Berkeley students when I officially got it wrong, is that when you look at it as minor 6, major 4, major 1, major 5, those are essentially the four most basic chords for pop music in the last 50 years. And you can rearrange those in whatever order you want and get a large proportion of all the songs that we've listened to over the last half century. You can start them at different points and get different songs. There's a comedian named Rob Paravonian who has something that a lot of people have seen on YouTube called Pachelbel Rant. He basically starts in the middle of my sensitive female chord progression. I start on the minor 6, he starts on the major 1, and he shows, he plays guitar as part of his act, and he goes through a number of songs that go major 1, major 5, minor 6, major 4. Wow, it's been good living with you. In my machine head, it's better than the rest. My machine head, it's better than the... See the stone set in her eye. See the thorn twist in her... I'm all out of faith. This is how I feel. I'm calling, I ain't same. Lying naked on the floor. He was a boy, she was a girl. Could it be any more obvious? We're not gonna take it. No, we ain't gonna take it. On your mark, it's set and go now. Got a dream and we just know now. And if you start this progression in another spot, if you start it at the major 4, you get Rihanna's Umbrella, you get Oasis' Supersonic.
Oh.
So it's basically, if you look at it as just one never-ending circle, you can almost start it at any spot and get a song.
What shall we go out with here? I want it to be rousing. Well, how about Beyoncé? And then we can sing along with her.
If I could sing along with Beyoncé,
right,
then I...
Your day is complete.
My day would be complete, yes.
That's entertainment writer Mark Hirsch speaking about the sensitive female chord progression that guys play too. Mark, thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Okay, hit it. 'Cause they stick up for me.
If I was one of us. It's too high for me. Just a small like one.
Let's try to get a find our key. Okay, let's listen. We can do this.
If I could have got one of us, I think I could have just a small like one of us.
Everybody.
Building a mystery.